Well, with me now on Fresh Air is Congressman Robert Edgar, Democrat from Delaware County. Edgar is a survivor, one of the few liberal Democrats to win during the 1980 election. He was targeted for defeat by conservative interest groups who rate him as one of the most liberal members of the House. The odds were also against him the first time he ran in 1974. A Democrat hadn't won a congressional seat in his district since 1857. He was the first Democratic Congress winner in 116 years. Edgar is now the chair of the Northeast Midwest Congressional Coalition, a group trying to block economic policies and programs that favor the Sunbelt region over other areas. He has made the flight of jobs and capital an important issue of the coalition. In 1980, Edgar was one of the participants in a fact-finding tour in Central America where they found many human rights violations in El Salvador. He's against U.S. military aid to El Salvador. He also thinks that many features of the administration's proposed economic program will be damaging to our region. He's argued for increased funding for mass transit. He's been active in environmental issues and helped Philadelphia win the Saratoga contract. He's also served as the chairman of the Veterans Subcommittee on Education, Training, and Employment. Robert Edgar is a Methodist minister and served as a pastor, then became Protestant chaplain at Drexel University, where he co-founded the People's Emergency Center. He's now serving his fourth term in the House. Welcome to Fresh Air.
It's good to be here.
Do you feel like a survivor, being a liberal Democrat in the House?
I feel like someone who was standing in a forest and had all the other trees cut down. Most of my friends lost the last election, 13 senators. People like Pete Kastenmeier and Andy McGuire and Bob Carr, all in the House, were defeated. And it's a little strange because there are fewer people who think as I do in Washington, and it makes my job that much harder.
You were targeted for defeat. What was the nature of that? How did that work?
Well, almost every special interest group puts a target list together. The pro-life community, the anti-abortion groups, also the moral majority groups, kind of coalesced and put together a hit list of 12 people, six senators and six House members. When the dust cleared after the November 4th election, only two of those 12 members survived, Morris Udall and myself. All the other people who were put on that hit list were recycled in the last election. And so it makes you one of very few who survived the kind of structured targeting that many of the ultra-conservative groups were doing in the last election.
Does that seem to you to be a reasonable part of the democratic process, or do you think that it's extreme and a danger in the democratic process, or a threat to the democratic process?
It's a danger, but it's an inevitable part of democracy. It's an inevitable result of computerized typewriters and computerized communication and the ability to target voting precincts and people who feel particular ways. I don't have any problem with people getting involved politically. I think there should be separation of church and state, but I don't think there should be separation of people of faith and strong feelings about their political expression. The thing that bothered me in the last election was the moral majority and Christian voice putting out moral ratings of who was moral and who was immoral in Congress. It struck me as very curious that several of the people who were involved in the Abscam problem got 100% moral ratings, and all of the ministers and priests in Congress got zeros. And it was a strange set of 14 votes out of 1,000. If you voted for the Department of Education, you were immoral. If you voted for recognition of Red China, you were immoral, and so forth. So I think that it's important for everyone to have freedom of expression and freedom of their ability to get involved in the political process. The place where I draw the line is when they start deciding who is the righteous or moral people versus who is the immoral people based on judgment calls rather than on specific issues.
You mentioned new technology as a way that people can be targeted because you've got these like mass letter writers that could type out and personalize thousands of letters in no time at all. Do you see liberal groups trying to use those techniques also to win back their place?
Well, I think that liberal groups are learning from the conservative groups. Clearly, the Vigory forces in Virginia were the first to nationalize the targeting and the computerization of political process. And I hear in the halls of Congress a number of the moderates and liberals saying, we should really have that computer technology. We should have that targeted mail technology. We should be able to zero in on people that we like and also put press releases out on people we dislike. I think that there'll be an attempt to move in that direction, but I don't think that the moderate to liberals will have the large amounts of money that's necessary to motivate a direct mail, targeted mail computerized operation. And I think you'll find that the groups that have the most money normally win the elections. And I don't see any trend stopping the more conservative movements winning many of the elections in the near future.
What do you think are the sources of, say, moral majority money and other conservative groups' money?
Well, I think conservatives, particularly fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalists in general, think of issues in very simplistic terms. And many times they will give to a cause because they think they're wiping out communism or they're wiping out a point of view that's different or at odds. In the moderate to liberal community, while we feel strongly and passionately about issues, we don't blindly support those issues with financial contributions. And I think they're able to organize perhaps even smaller numbers of people, but more dedicated to give resources.
Congressman Robert Edgar is my guest, and I do want to mention that a little later on in our conversation, we'll be opening up the studio telephone line. So if you have a question or comment, stick around and we'll be getting to it in probably about a half hour or so. Let's get to the proposed economic plan. And can you give us your overall appraisal?
Well, I think when President Reagan came before a joint session of the House and Senate on the 18th of February, he laid out four very simple ideas. A, he was going to cut federal spending. B, he was going to reduce taxes. C, he was going to increase defense. And D, he was going to balance the budget. And much of the mail that came in following that February 18th statement was very positive, support the president. On the 10th of March, the president came back with the details of his package. And I must have gone to the wrong schools because when I add up the package, it bothers me because the rhetoric of solving inflation and dealing with unemployment doesn't match the impact of what's going to be done. For example, the president wants to cut $48 billion of spending. He then wants to cut $54 billion of revenues in a general across-the-board tax cut. He then turns around and takes the $48 billion of saving and spends it on MX missiles and B-1 bombers and military so that there's a net washout of the spending savings. And when you go and then look at the deficit for next year, the deficit next year will be higher under the Reagan budget than it would have been under the Carter budget. The only stimulus that may have some impact down line on inflation is the tax side, and I have some specific concerns about the tax side not being targeted to rehabilitation, not being targeted to small business, and for the middle-income person being very small and not doing what the president hopes that it will do. But just on the spending side, there is, in fact, no less federal spending next year than this year. It's simply a movement from public transit, legal services, urban programs, people programs, over into defense, so that anyone who has been captured by the rhetoric that spending will be less next year, I think if they look at the hard facts of the budget, they'll discover that, in fact, spending is not lessened. It's about the same, and revenues are reduced, and therefore, because the revenues are reduced, the deficit is higher. And for the last 6 years that I've been in Congress, the conservatives and the Republicans have said high deficits cause inflation because it causes the federal government to borrow in the open market. Now those high deficits are okay.
The administration is literally on a sell campaign for the economic plan, and some of the key people in the administration this week are touring different states, I imagine for guest lectures and for spots on media programs, radio and television. What do you think of the way the program's being sold, and what do you think of the way the program's being presented, the information that's being used?
Well, it's a little bit disturbing that you're almost un-American if you disagree with the president and his policies. And I think that David Stockman and Vice President Bush and the others who are traveling the country selling their program ought to recognize that the president proposes certain things, budgets and policies, and it's up to one more than half of 535 House and Senate members to determine which of those programs get accepted. I think there's general approval in Washington for less federal spending to cut the waste and the bureaucracy. I think there's general support for a tax cut, maybe shaped different, may have more emphasis on small business or on the little person, but I think there's general acceptance there. The problem I'm having is that there doesn't seem to be a willingness on the part of the administration, now that they've laid out their program, to make adjustments. And for our region of the country, it's a little scary when you look at the implications of the president's budget when they don't cut tobacco subsidies, they don't cut the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway, they don't cut any of the major programs in the South and West, but they terminate the Economic Development Administration, which helps urban cities like Chester and Camden. They fold in the Urban Action Grant programs that have provided some jobs in this region. They take on things like the Legal Services Corporation and eliminate it, which provides legal services for the poor and the elderly. So I guess my problem is that the president's motives are not bad, but I'm frustrated with the inability of the new administration to work on compromises that would be regionally equitable and fair, as well as targeted to the persons of need. All of us agree we ought to cut waste, fraud, excess out of the budget. But I think it's where those cuts take place that we want to have some dialogue.
I'm actually very curious about what you see the president's and the rest of the people in the administration's motives as being, because you pointed out before that if you look at the mathematics of the budget, money has been being taken by a lot, from a lot of social service organizations and put into the military. Now, some people see the economic plan as having good motives, but perhaps not having the economic effects it wishes to have. Other people see it as just being a plan that covers up the hidden political agenda, which is to take away a lot of social service programs and put that money into the military, thus boosting the military and having a very sound rationale for doing it without having to talk too much about the military.
Well, I think there are conflicting motives at work at the same time. I think the overriding motive is that President Reagan wants to demonstrate that his administration is making a radical break with the past 10, 15, 20 years. And he's doing that. He's doing it through his rhetoric. He's doing it through some of the people he's put in positions of power. And he's making a statement that his administration will be different. I think he's fallen into a trap that Jimmy Carter fell into, and I think a lot of other presidents fall into, and that is the rhetoric of the campaign is difficult to match with the realities of being president of the United States. And I think Jimmy Carter was perceived as a failure. I think Ronald Reagan will be perceived as a failure. And I think anyone who assumes the position of president would be assumed as a failure, because we have somehow given people the impression that if you do this, 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 and this, inflation will be solved, energy problems will be solved, people will be employed. And our economy is just too complicated for simplistic answers. And I think the motives of the president in shaking up the bureaucracy, while good motives, will in fact be tempered by the realities of being president of the United States.
You've touched on what some of the effects to our region might be if the plan goes through. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yes. One thing that many people are unaware of, and that is as a result of deregulating fossil fuel oil, we have given a net windfall to 8 states, Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, California, and Alaska, and several others, of about $127 billion over the next 10 years. And so when you start cutting budgets nationally, cutting out programs, it has a different impact on different states. The have states who take a severance tax on every barrel of oil that's produced and every cubic foot of gas are able to rake into their treasuries great surpluses so that if they lose a federal program, they can adjust to that by using some of their surplus. In states like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, other states that just about balance their budgets and do not have severance tax revenues, a national cutback has implications. The president's budget goes further than that. Not only does it cut programs that help our region, but it fails to cut tobacco subsidies. It fails to cut water projects that are wasteful. Let me give you just 2 examples of wasteful water projects. One I mentioned earlier, the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway. This is a project to build an 8-lane tow barge system from Pickwick, Tennessee, to Demopolis, Alabama, and down to Mobile. Senator Pat Moynihan calls it the clone of the Mississippi because it parallels the Mississippi. Its alleged purpose is to take the coal out of Texas and Kentucky down to Mobile and save time rerouting the Tennessee River and providing this waterway. Last year, we spent $246 million on this project. This year, we're spending $225 million. And next year, we're going to spend $201 million. The total cost of the project is $3 billion. At the same time we're committing that kind of money, Boston loses 40% of its fresh water every day because of wooden water pipes and because of bad metering. The city of New York City is tenuously balanced on two water tunnels that provide fresh water to Manhattan that are 75 years old. There is zero federal commitment to Boston or New York, and yet, if you cut $100 million out of the 10-TOM project annually, you would still spend more money on that one project than any other project in the nation. And you could take that $100 million and either use it for other more meritorious projects or make that a federal savings. And I discovered a few weeks ago when I was down in the area that the contractors who are raking in the money to build this project, the first thing they do is set up lights so they can work 20 hours a day constructing the water project to get the project over half built so that no one will talk about shutting the project down. And I think it's a fraud that's being played on our region of the country when suddenly the federal government, with the Tennessee Valley Authority, with the highway programs, with the water programs, have given great access to the South and West. One other project, in the Central Arizona project, we're providing fresh water at great federal expense to Phoenix, Arizona, rerouting the Colorado River, without asking the people of New Mexico and Arizona to value the cost of that water. And I think water is our next big crisis, and we ought not to have a budget that continues wasteful water projects, including holding ponds for catfish farmers and other dumb projects that we provide. So I guess my bottom line concern is that when I look at the cuts that impact on the older aging cities, and see that the budget is slanted towards the in-migration areas of the South and West, but does not address the rehabilitation and reconstruction needs of the older cities and states, I wonder whether or not there isn't a regional inequity that should be spoken to. And fortunately, the House budget, different from the Reagan budget, is putting back in some money that may help our region. It's still cutting the $45 to $48 billion of spending, but it put back some Conrail money, which is the freight rail service. It put back some Economic Development Administration money, and it put back some funds that will help urban centers, and I think is probably a more equitable budget than the one that the president has offered.
You've laid out how a lot of money going to the Sun Belt area is, in a way, being siphoned off areas from the Northeast. Why do you think that's happening? You must have some ideas about that.
Well, it's happening for a number of reasons. First of all, our organization, the Northeast Midwest Coalition, formed in 1976, about 20 years too late. We formed after many of the changes had already occurred. I think secondly, many of the congressmen who were elected from the South and West were elected for life. They were put in positions on the Armed Services Committee or the Public Works Committee, and they would stay 20, 30, 40 years. We have a tendency in this region to recycle our congressmen much more quickly, and with the seniority system, they build up great power bases, and we simply did not build those same power bases. And I think a third reason was we were very complacent. The quality of life in the Philadelphias, the New Yorks, the Bostons, and Chicagos was pretty good. It was only when our aging infrastructure, our bridges, our roads, our public transit, our water and sewer systems began to deteriorate that we discovered industry not locating here and small new entrepreneurs not setting up shop here but moving to areas where they could find cheap energy, cheap land, and those things. So I think there's a number of ingredients that were put in place in the last 20 years that make the South and West much more attractive in terms of climate, energy, land cost, labor cost, and we have to now begin to fight to provide some help to rehabilitate and reconstruct our old aging areas so that we can improve the quality of life here and encourage people to stay.
I'm speaking with Congressman Robert Edgar, if you're just joining us, and we will be opening up the phones in a little while. So getting back to the House now, you've talked about how some of the budget has been shifted around so that the Northeast might suffer less with the House's proposed budget. What do you think is going to pass finally? What can you assess the mood in the House for us?
It's very difficult. Clearly, the White House is in moderate Republican hands. The Senate is in ultra-conservative Republican hands along the lines of a Jesse Helms. The House is in conservative hands. The 30 or 40 conservative Democrats from the South and West joining hands with the Republicans will pretty much lay out the agenda for the next 2 years. And my guess is that unless there's a great deal of leadership that I don't see at this present point, the Republican substitute supported by 30 or 40 of the conservative Democrats will probably pass, and the budget coming out of the House may look much closer to the administration's budget than the Jim Jones budget, which is essentially he's chairman of the House Budget Committee, and his budget, I think, has a little bit more saving grace for our region.
Do you think that effective tactics are being used by the Democrats who are in the House or who are in the Senate?
Well, really, there's no leadership at this point in history. We lost 13 Democrats in the Senate. On the House side, Tip O'Neill and Jim Wright, who are our so-called leaders, have a difficult time. I think they've been traumatized by the last election. Particularly, Tip has been shocked by the conservative Democrats and their ability to pull a coalition together and stand up and are counted with the Republicans. So I don't think that we have the kind of dynamic leadership that anyone is willing to blindly follow. And that causes a great deal of concern because we don't have the same ability to build coalitions. Our Northeast Midwest coalition has probably the best opportunity because we're bipartisan. We have conservatives, liberals, moderates, Democrats, Republicans who are looking at a regional agenda. And many times we're willing to break from the party rule simply to look at what's best for our region and the country. And I must say, we're not trying to be an unhealthy coalition. We think the South and West ought to form a Sun Belt coalition, and they've done that over the last couple of weeks. We think they ought to learn as much as they can about the problems of in-migration and planned growth. We think we have to assist them to develop the infrastructures for the in-migration of population. But we think that it would be a mistake for the older areas of the country not to address their problems and their needs in trying to repair the basic infrastructure.
If most of the Reagan budget plan is passed, what ultimately do you think is going to happen to us in the Delaware Valley? What do you see ahead?
Well, I think the first thing that's going to happen is that many people who voted for Ronald Reagan are going to be shocked when they see the outcome. Many people think, well, you're going to cut all these federal programs and that will be that. Unfortunately, many of the townships, the boroughs, the city services are based on federal dollars. And in some instances, I support the cuts, but think they ought to be, cities and communities ought to be weaned off of those support systems because we kind of gave them the thought that they would have legal services, they would have CETA funds, they would have basic economic revitalization dollars. To terminate them quickly, I think the trauma is going to be fairly great. My feeling is if Reagan's planned cuts do take effect, that the middle-income person who thinks that they're protected, that they have a safety net under them, are going to be startled. There are going to be senior citizens who will not have nutrition programs. There'll be cutbacks in services that people have taken for granted. There'll be people who will be looking for student loans for college students and find that they don't qualify. There'll be people who are looking for public transit service, and we'll see many of them being cut back and destroyed by the Reagan cuts. So I think a year from now, there'll be quite a trauma in the nation as people realize the impact of some of the cuts.
If the impact is assessed to be a negative impact, do you think programs will be able to be rebuilt, perhaps differently, but restored in some way? The services, that is.
I think some of them will, but if you terminate a program, it's almost impossible to put it back in place in a timely fashion. Legal services comes to mind, and I keep using that illustration, but that's one of the things that I think is really silly. Another that comes to mind is the 91 readjustment counseling centers for Vietnam-era veterans. We've just in the last 18 months put these 91 centers scattered throughout the nation to be storefront readjustment counseling centers. And if they are terminated, even if we were able to put them back in place in 2 years or 3 years, much of the damage of not finding the combat distressed veteran who is having a great deal of emotional problem would be lost, and I think it would be a great tragedy.
Americans are basically told that we have two ways of affecting what happens politically in the country. One is through the voting booth, and the other is through cards and letters to our congressmen and senators. How effective do you think the cards and letters are? Do you think that the votes that are happening now in the budget, for instance, are a direct result of the feedback they've gotten in the mail?
I think writing the congressperson is important, but I think it's fourth in a list of four ways to lobby a congressman. The first and best way to communicate is through eye contact, is figuring out how you can have a sit-down conversation with your elected representative in the House or Senate. Usually that meeting should take place in the district office, away from the bells of the House votes and away from the telephone, and confront the member by recognizing that he's a human person in a very complicated setting, and that the issues that you confront that congressperson with may be something they're not familiar with. For example, the funding for public radio and television. If you don't serve on a committee or subcommittee on which that is a part of the agenda, you may not know about it unless somebody comes and communicates. Second way to lobby a congressman is through the telephone, calling district offices, sharing ideas, trying to communicate with a congressman that way. Third way is to recognize each of us have a staff person who has a specialty on the issue that you're concerned about. Find out the staff person's name. If you're interested in solar energy, Bob Edgar, Bill Gray, other congresspeople have staff people who have that as their priority. Find out which office they're in and try to have a sit-down conversation with them. Then finally, if you can't have eye contact or telephone contact or staff contact, then write a personal letter trying to focus on one issue per letter. If it's two or three or four issues, it tends to be a clerical problem. You've got to share it around a number of staff people to get a response. The worst way to lobby a congressman is form letters, form postcards, form petitions. We don't weigh our mail or measure our mail or number our mail. We read it. And I can get 1,000 letters putting pressure on me to vote a particular way, all saying the same thing, and I can get 2 letters personally written that tell me something about the issue. Those 2 letters may have more impact than the 1,000 letters. The 1,000 letters or postcards are helpful in educating those 1,000 people who have written in, but they don't change the mind of the congressperson very often. And I've met very few congressmen in Washington who vote the way their cards and letters come in, or vote the way their polling data or their questionnaire results come in. We tend to represent our district by taking all of that input, plus the briefings, plus the staff inputs, plus our private education, plus our reading, and vote our best judgment 700, 800, 900 times a year. And it's impossible to know how your constituents feel on every issue. And I strongly believe that people should vote their best judgment, and every 2 years or 4 years, we come up for re-election, people have a chance to vote on us.
So from what you're saying, I get the impression that you don't really suffer a problem of should you vote your conscience or should you vote what your constituents tell you, because what you're saying is you're using all of that to form the best judgment that you can.
That's right. And if I vote only 10% of the time the way my constituents want me to vote, I'm not going to be around very long. But if I vote 70 or 80% of the time the way they want me to vote, and they recognize that I've made and cast that vote using my best judgment and the information that's available to me, I think they respect the fact that I may have more information on particular issues than they do. If they don't like that, then they have that opportunity to recycle me on a 2-year basis. And in the last couple of elections, they've tried.
I'm speaking with Congressman Robert Edgar, if you're just joining us, Democrat from Delaware County, and we will be opening up the phones in just a few minutes. You went on a fact-finding mission in El Salvador just a few months ago. Can you summarize for us the most striking findings there?
Well, there are 3 real striking findings, and that is that Alexander Haig and Ronald Reagan misunderstand El Salvador and Central America in 3 basic respects. First, they failed to deal with the indigenous nature of the revolution. That is, if there was no Cuba, no Russia, there would still be a revolution taking place in El Salvador. The oppression and repression that has existed for 50 to 100 years would still be there. And the pressure of population would still be there. There are 560 people per square mile. There's great need for land reform. Of the 5 million people, 100,000 own everything. The rest of the 5 million people own nothing. And there's a great deal of pressure there. Secondly, Alexander Haig and Ronald Reagan underestimate the role of Catholic liberation theology. That is, 15 years ago, the church was saying, the meek shall inherit the earth, so the meek should be quiet until they get their reward in heaven. Now, through the Maronals, the Jesuits, the Sister of Mercy nuns, and others, the message basically is the meek shall inherit the earth, but the meek have a right not to be raped or tortured or beaten. And I think that in all of the briefings that I received, there was little or nothing said about the role of the Catholic Church, and particularly the activist theology, in shaping the views of people in the field. And I found a great deal of opposition to the Duarte government, not solely by Marxist guerrillas trained in Cuba, but in fact by the religious community, by the professional community, and by others who just felt that the oppression was too severe and that they had a right to a better quality of life. And finally, I think that Alexander Haig and Ronald Reagan misunderstand El Salvador in thinking that a military solution is possible. Let's just take the worst-case scenario. Suppose four of the Green Berets are taken hostage, or one of them is shot, and you call up the Marines from Panama to land on the beaches of El Salvador. The question you have to ask is, who do you shoot? And I think they think that somehow you can go in and you can tell the difference between a Marxist-trained Cuban guerrilla and a right-wing paramilitary person who is very actively involved in assassination squads, or someone who's simply out in the street trying to provide some healing and health, a religious community worker or somebody providing service. And I think that to think a military solution is possible is to misunderstand what has been happening in that part of the world. I think the good offices of the United States ought to be used with Mexico and Venezuela and Germany and other nations of the world to bring all of the warring factions to the peace table and work out a negotiated political diplomatic solution rather than a military solution to that conflict.
Well, you referred to Cuba and the Soviet Union and said that this conflict in El Salvador would exist whether those countries existed or not, but the official statements from the White House about El Salvador always include Cuba and the Soviet Union. Why do you think they're emphasizing those?
Well, I think early on, Alexander Haig thought that he could punch Cuba and Russia in the eye quickly by way of El Salvador. And I believe that they thought they had a ready-made situation where if they stood up to the Cuban-Russian involvement that they could somehow get domestic support. But what I think they failed to recognize is that far more was going on in El Salvador than the guns that were being provided by the Cubans particularly. And I think as we up the bullets and the lethal military aid, we simply form a vacuum that gets filled with more military aid coming from other countries, as well as we create some of the very kinds of people, some of the very kinds of attitudes that we don't want to create as a democratic, people-oriented country.
So you and Barbara Mikulski come back from this fact-finding tour in El Salvador. Do you have a receptive audience when you come back to Washington?
Well, surprisingly, we do. We have over 80 co-sponsors of H.R. 1509, which is a bill to cut off military aid to the government of Napoleon Duarte. But more importantly, the traditional Roman Catholic Church, which is usually very conservative in matters of international affairs, has stood up in a very strong way and said, why should we be giving bullets and lethal aid to the very military that caused the death of the three religious nuns and the Catholic religious worker on December 4th? Why should we be giving lethal military aid to a military that's out of control, as exemplified by the 30 people who were shot just last week in a confrontation late one night in one of the suburbs of San Salvador? And I think the Roman Catholic Church's leadership in this whole area has been helpful in toning the administration's activities and as well as the president's.
So do you see a de-escalation of American involvement?
I think that in the last few weeks, I've seen a toning down of some of the rhetoric, which has been very helpful.
Okay, I'm speaking with Congressman Robert Edgar, and we're going to invite you to call up with any questions or comments that you'd like to address to him. Our phone number is area code 215-923-2774. Again, at area code 215, the number is 923-2774. When Jean Kirkpatrick was appointed as ambassador to the United Nations, she made a statement saying that she thought that human rights considerations should be secondary when it came to figuring out which governments we should support, and the primary consideration should be what government is friendly to the United States. And if a government's friendly, whether or not there's suppression of human rights, there shouldn't be the major issue. How do you feel about that statement?
Well, I feel that she's wrong, and she also said that the four nuns who were killed were probably involved in some political activity rather than religious activity in Central America, and I think she's wrong on that stand. My feeling is human rights is very important, and that the President of the United States in the previous administration, Jimmy Carter, did a good service to the world in helping people to recognize that we should oppose human rights violations on the far right and the far left. And I think this new administration's focus away from human rights to terrorism is okay if you recognize that there are terrorists on all extremes. But I have the fear that the movement away from human rights is in a support of a policy against terrorism if that terrorism is terrorism inflicted by a particular ideology that this administration doesn't like. But if, for example, in El Salvador, the military in control violates people's rights, has no search and seizure procedures, rapes or tortures or beats a particular family, that suddenly that's okay. And I think that the new administration, if it wants to make that shift, which I think is regrettable, then they ought to make that shift in a very honest and upfront way and oppose terrorism, whether it's on the far right or the far left.
Okay. We'll take some phone calls now, and I believe we have some people ready to be spoken with. And let's go to the phones. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to ask the congressman who sits on the Veterans Affairs Committee what he feels about possibly extending the delimiting dates of veterans' benefits. Many Vietnam era veterans have not used their veterans' benefits because the amount of stipend was not realistic in assisting them in going to school. With the demographics as they are and the baby bulge coming down and fiscal cutbacks across the board federally and in many states, a lot of colleges are going to be under pressure in helping to assist their students to finance their education. This is an excellent opportunity to help veterans and to help colleges filling their seats and taking pressure off students that will still be able to go. And what I'm asking him in short is, does he feel that the delimiting dates can be extended? The percentage of the Vietnam-era veterans that have used those benefits was small by historical comparison to the World War II veterans, whose benefits were a lot better. They were more realistic in assisting a student to go to school.
Could okay.
you comment on that?
Yes. I have several comments I'd like to make. First of all, I offered the amendment back in 1975 to eliminate the 10-year delimiting date and allow a veteran to use the full 36 months or 45 months of benefits that accrued that veteran during their service to the nation. Unfortunately, that vote lost, and I have supported in each year the extension of the delimiting date. There is a bill that I'm a co-sponsor of this year that is a little bit more limited but helpful, I think, in providing $63 million to extend the delimiting date for those veterans who come into the readjustment counseling centers and who, because of emotional problems or the pressure of the conflict in Vietnam and the coming back and finding it a very unpopular war, failed to enroll and use their benefits in a timely fashion. I don't think, given the Reagan cuts of some $800 million in veterans programs and the more conservative view in Washington, that the delimiting date across the board will be extended. My hope is that Tom Daschle from South Dakota and I, who serve on the Veterans Affairs Committee, can get this more limited extension passed. I would also make this point. I'm working, in fact, on Thursday I'll be in Boston for some hearings, and the 1st of May we hope to mark up a bill called H.R. 1400 to provide for recruitment and retention in the all-volunteer Army a new GI Bill, because I think we've discovered both in the Vietnam conflict and earlier that every dollar we invest in GI education we get back 3 and 4 times fold by increased ability of those veterans to earn a good living and pay some taxes. I think it was a mistake that the Congress of the United States accepted Jerry Ford's recommendation to terminate the Vietnam-era GI Bill on December 31st of 1976, and my hope is that in the next few months we'll be able to restore a GI Bill for the all-volunteer forces that are presently in force. But to answer your specific question, I don't think the conservative mood in Washington is conducive to extending the delimiting date for Vietnam-era veterans. I think that's unfortunate, but unfortunately we don't have a majority of the 535 people who agree with me.
Okay, thank you very much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. I'm going to ask everybody who is calling now to keep their comments to about 1 minute so that we can get in as many people as we can. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and if you could keep your question or comment to 60 seconds or less, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, fine. I have a question for the congressman, which basically applies more to the Democrats in the Congress and the Senate than to him himself. I'm just wondering why the Democratic Party has been, it seems at least in terms of the press coverage, so overwhelmingly defensive in relationship to the Reagan and Stockman proposals. Treasury Secretary Reagan made a statement about a week ago saying, well, why should the president compromise at all, because the Democrats seem to be coming toward him instead of the other way around, and he seems to have, I might not agree with anything else that he's been saying, but that statement seems to be really true. And in light of the fact of recent Gallup polls, which basically show that the electorate really hasn't swung substantially to the right, and also in light of polls taken which regarding President Reagan's popularity, which although show him very popular, show him less popular for this amount of time after an election than any president in recent history, I'm wondering why there's this, it just seems like almost a phobia to oppose any substantial program that Reagan submits.
Well, first of all, I have not found any hesitancy in opposing the president on his cuts in veterans programs, public transit, urban policy, and some of his inequities in his tax policy and his budget policy. But I think you've hit on an interesting point. First, the leadership question. Remember how many people lost the last election. My side didn't win. Many senators who were taking courageous leadership positions on issues, the Birch Buys, the Frank Churches, the Senator Nelsons, the McGoverns, et cetera, were recycled in the last election. On the House side, there were people who were taking environmental positions, renewable energy source positions, who were recycled in the last election. Secondly, the leadership on the Democratic side in the House, namely Tip O'Neill, I think has been traumatized by the loss of so many people and the pressure that he's under by the conservatives. And in my opinion, Tip has a great deal of difficulty leading in that kind of an environment. The question of defensiveness, I think there have been defensive statements on the part of Jim Wright and Tip O'Neill. I find it incredible that the two major issues for the first 3 months of this administration that the Democratic leadership took on with the new administration was to support the new administration on El Salvador and oppose cuts in the synthetic fuels administration. In my opinion, they were wrong on El Salvador. They were also wrong in looking at the Synfuels Corporation as the thing to protect when a lot of other more important issues were there to protect. If you think of the $50 billion of cuts as translating into 70 programs, and if you think of each of those 70 programs as being a bulldozer, there are plenty of bulldozers to fall in front of in this administration. The problem isn't the areas to fight. The question is, what is the best strategy for turning this around? And I don't think we have the leadership in place that's going to put that kind of strategy together. Our coalition is going to make some attempts because of our bipartisan support, and perhaps that's really the new wave of political coalitions, and that is to cut across Democratic and Republican lines, conservative and liberal lines, and look at the economic vitality of a region. I mean, if you look at the termination of Conrail, the cutbacks in Amtrak, the termination of maintenance for public transit systems, just in the transit area, the northeast region of the country is devastated by the new administration's proposals. And I'm not defensive about that. I'm angry about that. And I know that there are Republicans who are angry about that as well. And it's very difficult. The first honeymoon was the first 3 months in office. And with the assassination attempt, there's a second honeymoon in place. Very difficult to get at the new administration. And then the new administration's tact is to say anybody who disagrees with any piece of the economic package is somehow un-American, makes it even more incredible for people to stand up and be counted. And then you look around and you see how many people lost the last election. I see members of Congress that I respect who were very outspoken in the last 6 years who suddenly seem very muffled in their response, and I think that's unfortunate.
But isn't it interesting that in many cases, many of the senators and congressmen who lost were still doing substantially better than the head of the ticket, even when their stances were on record a lot more distant from President Reagan and Stockman and so forth than the president himself. What I'm really afraid
of... Okay, listen, I hate to cut you off, but I do want to get to some other people.
Okay, I wanted to say that I'm afraid that if the Democrats begin to start parroting Republican principles, then if the public attitude changes and turns around, there'll be no one for them to go to.
I agree.
Okay, thanks very much for your phone call.
Great.
My guest is Congressman Robert Edgar. If you're just joining us, hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and I'd appreciate it if you could keep your comment to a minute or less.
Okay. My name's Jim Miller. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I served in Vietnam twice. Congressman, I'm wondering about this new thing called delayed stress neurosis. It's been comparatively new in terms of its concept as far as being put out to the public in the news and everything. I was wondering, what do you think public opinion is of this concept? How readily do you think it's being accepted? What are your personal feelings about delayed stress neurosis in terms of it being a valid concept? And also, how do you think Congress and the Veterans Administration is going to react to it?
Well, let me answer your question. I think that Dr. Laufer and several others who work for the Center for Policy Studies in New York, who just released their major five-year comprehensive study of Vietnam veterans, have made a great contribution to public understanding of something called delayed stress syndrome. And that is what you're describing as the reaction to combat veterans to the trauma of coming back within 48 hours of serving in the jungle to a nation that looked upon that war in a very negative way. And many of those veterans we're finding in our readjustment counseling centers are just now coming around to coming in and trying to explore problems related to Agent Orange, problems related to family difficulties, problems related to the lack of jobs, problems related to education, emotional problems and adjustment problems. And Dr. Laufer's study and others have indicated there is a different response being exhibited in the Vietnam-era veteran than was exhibited in the Korean era and in the World War II-era veteran because of the lack of a sense of victory, the lack of the parade, the lack of the celebration, the lack of a completeness in that service, plus the trauma of serving in a jungle environment with defoliants and other chemicals that caused a great deal of emotional stress. What's Congress going to do about it? My hope is that more education and information of members of Congress, more direct eye contact with congressmen who don't serve on the Veterans Affairs Committee, so that they can understand the need for readjustment counseling centers, for employment programs targeted to Vietnam veterans, and the recognition that there are 500,000 veterans out there who served in the Vietnam conflict who are not being serviced by any of the traditional veterans hospital systems, who have a great deal of emotional and physical problems that are not being addressed and who are, in many instances, being forgotten.
Thank you very much for your phone call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Please keep your comment under a minute.
Hi, congratulations on your fourth miracle. And briefly, I understand that owing to the census, Pennsylvania is slated to lose a congressional seat, and that in light of the fact that the Pennsylvania Senate and the Pennsylvania House are in Republican hands, that people have decided that because you seem to be invulnerable in what is a fairly conservative district, that at the polls, at least, that this is one that by gerrymandering you out of a seat, this is one way of getting you out of Congress. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, we're going to lose two seats in Pennsylvania. We presently have 25 House seats. We're going to lose two of those House seats and bring the delegation down to 23. And just as a footnote, we're going to lose 17 congressmen from the northern tier states who will show up in Florida and Texas and California as the population has moved. But in Pennsylvania, the state House of Representatives and State Senate will be carving out 23 congressional seats, and there has been a great deal of interest in whether or not Bob Edgar's district in suburban Philadelphia is going to be one of those districts. I have a district that has 166,000 registered Republicans and about 60,000 Democrats, and on any computerized printout, it looks like Bob Edgar should be defeated in that district, and yet I keep coming back and winning. I think I'm going to be third on the list of priorities for the state Republicans. First, I think they'll take a seat out of Pittsburgh area and a seat out of the Philadelphia area, because that's where the major loss of population has occurred. Secondly, I think they'll shore up their victories in the Wilkesboro area, in the former Dan Flood seat, and in the Pete Kostemeyer, Jim Coyne seat in Bucks County. I think with Jim Coyne winning that seat, there are two new Republicans in Washington, and I think there'll be some effort to make sure that they are reelected in the next election and more Republican people will be stuffed into those districts. And then thirdly, I think they'll turn to Delaware County and say, how can we get Bob Edgar? And they can get Bob Edgar in a number of ways, and I think they'll make that attempt. I hope I've convinced the Republicans and independents in my district that whatever they do with redistricting, it's in our best interest as a county to have a congressman after redistricting. Now, they could take my district and divide it up with three other congressmen getting a piece of it and Bob Edgar being out of a seat or having to run against one of those congressmen. But I think the county council and the Chamber of Commerce in Delaware County, as much as some of them would like to see a Republican hold that seat, they would also like to have a congressman that they can think of as Delaware County's representative in Washington. If Boeing Vertol has a problem or if there's a problem in Chester, they don't turn to Dick Schulz, who has 100,000 Delaware County constituents. They turn to Bob Edgar, who has most of Delaware County. There are 553,000 people who live in Delaware County. We need 515,000 to 519,000 in a congressional seat so they can redesign my district totally within the boundary lines of Delaware County without ever pushing me into Philadelphia or pushing me into Montgomery or Chester County. And I think I've convinced them that that's in the best interest of everybody.
Thanks very much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air. Please keep your question to under a minute.
Congressman Edgar, I've been very distressed over the last few years at the extremely poor reportage on the Northern Ireland situation by the commercial media, and was very pleased to see you attend a lecture by a British barrister at the Ethical Society a couple of months ago outlining the legal injustice system that Britain employs in Northern Ireland. It was mentioned at that time that you would possibly take a fact-finding trip to Northern Ireland in the near future. I was wondering if you are still considering that or what's the latest on that?
Well, I'm still considering it. I have six major priorities right now, the urban policy and the public transit policy and the water policy, the veterans policy, the regional policy, and my concern on Central America. I still have a deep concern about the human rights problems in Northern Ireland and have continued to monitor them on a week-to-week, a month-to-month basis. And I hope sometime in this 2 years to be able to spend a few days getting a first-hand observation of the problems that are there. It's a problem of time, and it's a problem of fitting it into a schedule that increasingly is getting more and more complicated given the new administration's focus. I mentioned at the top of the show that it's a little bit like standing in a forest and having all the other trees cut down. With fewer people who feel as I do in Washington, a great deal more pressure has come on to me to take a front position on some of these major issues. And it gives me less time to be free to explore problems like the problem in Northern Ireland. But it's still something I'd like to do. I have some other areas of interest around the world that I'd like to pursue. But at this time in my history, I've got to be focused on some of the budget needs and some of the regional concerns.
I wonder if you could...
Oh, I'm sorry, we're going to try to get to another question. Thank you very much for calling. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air, and please keep your question to under a minute.
Okay, certainly. Congressman Edgar, I've heard you remark several times that, well, not during this program, that you favor gasoline refinery taxes of some sort of like what California and Texas have, I believe, were your examples. Don't these taxes on the refineries, aren't they ultimately passed on to the distributor who passes them on to the consumer, so they're just making the same amount of money as they would have if there had been no tax at all?
Yeah, I think you're wrong in your information. I do not support a refinery tax. I think that that's wrong. I do support a tax on gasoline. I think, for example, the state level, there ought to be a percentage tax put on because of the lower consumption. I think we need some additional revenues that are equally shared with highways and public transit. But I do not support a targeted refinery tax and think that that would be a mistake in terms of where those refineries would eventually end up. And I think it's a mistake to move in that direction. But don't think it's a mistake to commit fairly sizable amounts of funds to our public transit systems, which have been neglected.
Thank you very much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's all the phone calls we're going to have time for. You have said, Bob Edgar, that you wouldn't serve for more than 12 years in the House and that you don't think anyone should and that that should be the limit. Why do you believe that?
Well, I just, I guess maybe going to Washington as I did with such little political experience, looking around, it seemed to me that many of the people who stayed beyond the 12th year got very stale and did not serve their constituents very well. So I've been a supporter in each of the four Congresses that I've served in changing the number of years you serve from 2 years to 4 years. And I say that because I'm really a congressman for a year and then somebody's out running against me. And I think having an election every 2 years is, in the kind of contemporary society we have and complicated society, too quick. But then limit the number of terms to three so that you recycle congressmen after 12 years. Even if you recycled after 16 years, that would be a reform. And I think it would be a healthy reform. I think it would be important for us to get people elected who would not think that the only thing they can do in life is to be a congressman.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I wonder if you have any idea what you'll be doing when you leave the House.
Oh, I don't know. 12 years in the House of Representatives will look good on my resume. In 1986, there are a couple other offices up, like the Senate office and the governorship. I may explore that possibility. I may do some teaching at one of the area universities.
Well, I hope you could come back to Fresh Air and talk with us again soon. It's been very interesting to talk with you. Thank you very much.
I'd like that.
I've been speaking with Congressman Bob Edgar of Delaware County, and he's now serving his fourth term in the House of Representatives.